All right, our next speaker is Heather Darnell, How the Federal Government Transformed Folk Music, Documentation, and Preservation During the Great Depression. Heather Darnell is graduating next week with a Master's in Library Science with a specialization in Archives and Records Management from the University of Maryland. She earned a dual BA in Music and Classics from Texas Tech University, where she performed traditional music and dance under the TTU Vernacular Music Center. She has worked on numerous performing arts collections at the TTU University Archives, Smithsonian Ralph Rinzler Folklife Archives and Collections, and currently UMD's Special Collections in the Performing Arts. Please welcome Heather.
Thank you. I wanted to give a quick disclaimer. As often happens, my research has taken me down a couple of new avenues since I began and submitted my abstract. It's on the same topic, but it's going to be a little bit different than what's in the program. So, in his 2007 article, Archives for All, Professional Responsibility and Social Justice, Randall C. Jimerson states that archivists have a professional responsibility to be activists. This is not only limited to protecting the rights of the citizens, but also to promoting diversity, preserving vital aspects of cultural heritage, and balancing the historical record to include those who are marginalized and silenced. While activism in archives is a hot topic today, these ideas were embodied almost 80 years ago during a series of ambitious projects under the New Deal. During this time, the Library of Congress Archive of American Folk Song, which later became part of the American Folklife Center, used the New Deal as a platform for political activism. Under New Deal programs such as the Works Progress Administration, they were able to gather recordings, field notes, and photographs of folklore across the country in what was one of the greatest archival outreach efforts in U.S. history. In doing so, they sought to uplift the working class, give a voice to the ordinary American, and preserve the folklife of minorities and underrepresented groups. These were revolutionary and controversial aims for the time, and much of their motivation was rooted in leftist politics. In the end, field workers from almost every state rallied together to gain thousands of invaluable sound recordings, photographs, and field notes representing many aspects of the nation's cultural heritage. At the same time, the liberal activism of several of their key leaders contributed to making New Deal art programs a target for conservative reactionaries, and the programs were disbanded only years after they came into fruition. In this presentation, we will study some of the key actors in the New Deal folklife programs, how their activist approach succeeded, where it went wrong, and what this means for modern archives. When Franklin D. Roosevelt became president in 1933, he was charged with the daunting task of bringing the nation out of the worst economic collapse in history. Through a series of domestic programs called the New Deal, Roosevelt sought to relieve the unemployed and boost the economy. In order to make this work, he needed to rally the American public, especially those in the working class who were hardest hit by the crash. He also needed to appeal to everyone, as many Americans as possible, which meant also focusing on minorities. Through his rhetoric, he painted a picture of ordinary Americans, the folk, as the backbone of the country. Part of this image included hearkening back to a nostalgic view of the country's past so that Americans could find strength in their cultural heritage. He publicly embraced folk music by hosting a series of folk music concerts at the White House, which included Appalachian music to singers in the Gullah dialect. Eleanor Roosevelt also showcased her love of folk music by making a very public appearance at the White Top Folk Festival in Virginia. So it was through this embrace that President Roosevelt sought to showcase the diverse cultural fabric of America and uplift the common man. In the years preceding and throughout Roosevelt's presidency, several key folklorists that would come to be affiliated with the Library of Congress Archive of American Folk Song and take a large part in New Deal programs were pushing the boundaries of folk song collection and documentation. Their ideas were influenced by leftist politics of the time and often resonated with the growing Communist Party and labor movement. As Benjamin Faleen puts it in his work, Romancing the Folk, American Roots Music, and Public Memory, they formed a folk music establishment in Washington that took an activist approach to preserving and promoting folklore. Folk music documentation in the U.S. at the turn of the 20th century was largely focused on rural Anglo-American music at the expense of other cultural and ethnic groups. However, as folk song collection and scholarship reached the 20s, several scholars began to give a broader, more inclusive definition. Two of the most influential, Robert Winslow Gordon and John Lomax, would go on to become leaders at the Library of Congress Archive of Folk Song. So Robert Winslow Gordon was an enthusiastic folk song collector who not only collected Western folk song, but also sought to collect America's wider diaspora, including Afro-American traditions on the Georgia coast. He convinced Carl Engel, chief of the music division of the Library of Congress, of the importance of folk life. And the Library of Congress Archive of American Folk Song was founded in 1928, with Gordon as the director. From the start, the archive was founded on principles that were quite revolutionary for its time. It encouraged the documentation of ordinary folk and ethnic and cultural groups outside the Western scope. This wasn't done at a time when most archives in the U.S. focused not on the public masses or on underrepresented groups, but on the great canon of historical elites. Furthermore, under Gordon, the archive sought to go out and actively collect material instead of passively waiting for it to come to them. Unfortunately, Gordon's tenure was short-lived, and his position ended in 1933 as Roosevelt took the presidency. However, his revolutionary vision lived on. He was soon succeeded by a certain folklorist we all know named John Lomax. Though Lomax is noted to have many conservative viewpoints, he was another collector who diverged from only collecting Western music by also taking an interest in African-American traditions. He became famous for his folk songs expeditions throughout the South and is known for collecting black music in prisons and recording narratives of ex-slaves. As John Lomax was rising to prominence in the 30s, American folk music was taking on a decidedly different tone. The Communist Party USA had been building since 1919, taking a prominent role in the U.S. labor movement. Through it, folk music became a growing part of left-wing functions, seen as a way to appeal to the masses. By 1935, the Communist Party announced its Popular Front policy that urged Americans to find strength and diversity and come together for a common cause. Furthermore, the Popular Front's American Music League listed as one of its goals to document and popularize American folk music. Emerging folklorists during this time were influenced by these views and did not divorce newly created folk music from vernacular traditions. As mentioned before, Lomax's son, Alan, who was a young man during the 30s, accompanied his father on folk expeditions. As most children with conservative parents do, Alan became considerably more liberal than his father as he grew into adulthood. This served as a great source of tension between he and John, so much so that he says that there were several arguments that they engaged in concerning communism. Alan Lomax also had more liberal views on segregation, recalling disdain when his father mentioned that he believed that blacks accepted their subservient status in the South. This tension, however, did not stop them from working together to document folk music, and Alan became the Archive of American Folk Song's first federally funded staff member in 36 and assistant in charge in 37, taking a central role in New Deal efforts with his father. Another major actor in the New Deal folklore programs was Benjamin A. Botkin. He edited the annual Folk Say anthologies from 1929 to 1932, which included radical contributors such as Carl Sandburg and Harlem Renaissance leader Langston Hughes. Furthermore, he had a totally new concept of folklore. While folklorists of the past looked at folklore as something static, he viewed folklore as ever-evolving. He contended that folklore was created by people for use in their daily lives. This new school of anthropological thought was in stark contrast to earlier folklorists, who often viewed folklore as static and low on the evolutionary scale. Like Roosevelt, he viewed the ordinary man, his customs, and his music as relevant. The last key player in the New Deal folk music projects we will go over today was famed musicologist and composer Charles Seeger. Seeger was closely affiliated with the Communist Party USA, writing for the Daily Worker under the pseudonym Carl Sand. He had been part of the Composers Collective, a radical group of composers affiliated with the Workers' Music League. While not a fan of folk music at first, Seeger soon saw how it could be used to connect with the public. He wrote in the Daily Worker in 1938, "Unquestionably, the musical soul of America is in its folk music." He contributed to the Composers Collective's leftist songbook, including songbooks, including Song of the People in 1937, which included folk songs that used American traditional tunes. By the time President Roosevelt announced his New Deal, there was already a folk music establishment, one that promoted radical new ideas about what folk music was, who it encompassed, and why it was important. It was more inclusive than the previous definitions of folk music and sought to uplift the common man. Many of these ideas were closely aligned with leftist values of the time, including the goals of the Communist Party's Popular Front. The New Deal would soon give the establishment the opportunity to push their efforts into national focus. With government funding at the Archive of American Folk Song, John and Alan Lomax were able to fund large-scale documentation expeditions across the U.S. Furthermore, they were able to fund better equipment and create a recording equipment loan program. In the slide above is a letter approving recording equipment from the Library of Congress for a recording expedition led by B.A. Botkin. The library agreed to furnish him with, quote, 312-inch acetate discs, 6 sapphire cutting needles, 500 playback needles, 40 rolls of film, and 10 rolls of 16-millimeter moving picture film. And that comes from the National Archives. The Archive of Folk Song gathered materials through New Deal programs, which included the Resettlement Administration, Farm Security Administration, and the Works Progress Administration. This included the Federal Writers Project, the Federal Music Project, the Federal Theater Project, the National Youth Administration, and the Joint Committee on Folk Arts, which later brought a lot of those administrations under the Works Progress Administration together. So to sum up what everyone was doing during the New Deal, Alan Lomax served as assistant in charge, and he went on numerous expeditions. John Lomax worked at the archive. He was the head of the archive and also went on expeditions, served as the Federal Writers Project first folklore editor. During this time, he saw folklore documentation in the FWP, which included field workers at the state and local level in every region of the country. He was succeeded as folklore editor by B.A. Botkin, who then became FWP chief editor of the Writers Unit of the Library of Congress and chairman of the Joint Committee on Folk Arts. Another member of the Joint Committee of Folk Arts was our favorite Charles Seeger, who headed the Special Skills Division of the Resettlement Administration and created a music program. He also became assistant director of the Federal Music Project in 1937. And there was a series of folk music collection programs under that. Together, these individuals, along with the support of many others, rallied America to collect and preserve its cultural heritage. One example of the excitement these folklorists created can be seen in the report of one area supervisor in the Federal Music Project. And I quote, "Neither heat, wars, pestilence, nor politics have even slowed up the pace of workers in my area. If there is a melody lurking anywhere in any of the 11 counties which I supervise, it will not be for long, because the Federal Music Project workers do not have ears for the word no." And that comes from the very enthusiastic Mrs. J.C. Green, Area Supervisor, District 1, Lee County, Mississippi. As mentioned before, a large part of their effort was to promote diversity in ordinary Americans through documentation and preservation. They sought to balance the historical record by including cultures outside of the Anglo-American scope. As the Archive of American Folk Song published in its Manual for Folklore Studies, the aim should be to choose types and groups that have not yet been fully treated. In one letter, the Montana State Director of the FWP even suggested to the director of the Federal Writers Project that field workers collect music based on racial percentages in the state. New Deal folklorists recorded and documented more cultural and ethnic groups than ever before. The WPA Federal Writers Project Florida recordings included African American, Arabic, Bahamian, British American, Cuban, Greek, and Slavic music. In affiliation with the Federal Writers Project, Roscoe E. Lewis recorded black spirituals, sermons, and ex-slave narratives. Under the Farm Security Administration, Charles L. Todd and Robert Sonkin documented Mexican immigrants living in the El Rio FSA camp. All of these materials made their way back to the Archive of American Folk Song. New Deal projects also sought to represent the working man through documentation and preservation. The Manual of Folklore Studies encouraged workers to record work songs and labor songs. Alan Lomax sought to document the folk life of the coal mining community in Appalachia. Similarly, under the Farm Security Administration, Charles Todd and Robert Sonkin took recording equipment from the Archive of American Folk Songs program to California to record the folklore of migrant workers. So let's look at a few examples of these projects. Here's a letter from William Cunningham of the FWP project in Oklahoma on ex-slave interviews. In it, he says, ex-slave interviews seem to be the most productive field we have hit yet. Here we have a newspaper article reporting the expeditions in Florida. It enumerates the cultural and ethnic groups being recorded for the Library of Congress. It reads, folk and immigrant tunes to be recorded for filing in Library of Congress. Lastly, we have a slide with Charles Todd recording a group of Mexican men and boys at the Farm Settlement Administration. Now, it should be noted that although these programs intended well, they weren't perfect. Though enthusiastic, as we saw before, field workers were often untrained and unaware of current anthropological or archival methods. Though the Archive of American Folk Song provided them with manuals that contained questionnaires and information on folklore, many state reports were still riddled with exoticism and primitivism. For example, state reports from Mississippi often refer to African Americans by derogatory names. Similarly, state reports from the FWP about Native Americans often depict them as primitive or uncivilized. However, overall, the efforts of the Archive of American Folk Song still pushed the boundaries of what folk music encompassed and gave the opportunity to take part in discovering America's cultural heritage. While these efforts were largely successful in increasing the Archive of Folk Songs collections, they were short-lived. By the late 30s, New Deal art programs became the target of conservative opponents in Congress. The Committee to Investigate Un-American Activities opened hearing to investigate charges that the WPA art programs were led by communists who were using federal funding to fuel their agenda. By the next year, the House Committee on Appropriations began to investigate. On top of political opposition, World War II contributed to the demise of New Deal arts and folklore programs, and the WPA decided to cut funding to projects that didn't relate to the war, including folk music. By 1942, just 7 years after the WPA, New Deal folk music programs were over. Furthermore, Congress cut funding for folk song collection at the Library of Congress. And soon afterward, key leaders in the folk music establishment, including Alan Lomax, B.A. Botkin, and Charles Seeger, were all investigated by the FBI for communist activities. In essence, through the New Deal, a folk music establishment largely centered around the Archive of American Folk Song sought an activist approach to preserving cultural heritage. Their views were closely aligned with leftist politics, and they used the New Deal, a controversial government program, as a platform for their national activism. Their endeavors had several negative or questionable outcomes. For example, their obvious alignment with the left earned them powerful enemies in Congress, contributing to their demise. Secondly, their plan to reach out and work with the public didn't always result in professional work. Many of the field workers that contributed had prejudices that shaped the historical record. As archivists that actively sought and recorded folk music, the folk establishment's own views and perceptions also contributed to molding the historical record. These results might lead us to believe that the New Deal folklorist approach was unethical. After all, aren't archivists supposed to be the impartial custodians of history? To quote Vern Harris, "The archive is politics." When we passively allow records to come to us, we're making a political decision. When we choose one collection over another, we're making a political decision. When we describe materials or make them accessible or put them online or choose one over the other, we're making decisions. So as Randall C. Jimerson says, it is not only our professional responsibility to make decisions, but to make them objectively and to adhere to the principles of honesty, accountability, and transparency. Though these folklorists' activism led to some negative outcomes, it also led to pioneering accomplishments. Not only did they provide us with bounds of invaluable resources, but they paved the way for programs we have today. For example, the Veterans History Project, which provides citizens with tools to conduct oral histories and submit them to the Library of Congress. Or I would even say the Smithsonian Folklife Festival, which uses citizen volunteers to record and document folk music and dance performances. So someday, some archivists might look back on our decisions and see our errors and biases. However, that should not deter us from making objective decisions for the betterment of society. After all, it is through activism that we take risks, we learn from them, and we push new boundaries. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Heather. Any questions for Heather? Yes, sir.
During this period, was there any effort to document Native American music?
Yes, there was. I know for a fact that under the Farm Settlement Administration, they documented the music of several tribes. I'm not sure about the other New Deal programs, but yeah, there was a pretty big effort, actually.
Yes, sir.
I'll definitely look into that. I've been mainly looking through archival materials at the National Archives in the Music Division, and at the books that I listed above provide a pretty good background that helped me establish what the folk music establishment was. But I'll take that down and read it as well.
Go ahead, back.
Oh, I don't think that Ben Botkin was a communist. I was kind of... Sure. Let me see if I can explain this a little bit better. On that slide, the communist slide, I was just saying that those people were being investigated for being communists. But I would say that Benjamin Botkin and Alan Lomax and Charles Seeger and the others were aligned with a very controversial government program that was aligned with the left. And that was the New Deal. A lot of people were very against the New Deal. Conservatives targeted the New Deal. And I think that there were so many ideas coming together from anthropology was coming at the same time as these leftist politics, but I think that they blended together. And I think that especially Alan Lomax and especially Charles Seeger, who was a communist, were very influenced by this at the time, and that helped create the fervor of these programs. You know, John Lomax, he wasn't a communist either. In fact, he was much more conservative. Alan Lomax wasn't proven to ever be a communist, but he was very influenced by the left. And so I was looking at these main people who led a lot of these programs and how they were affiliated with the left and how the left influenced them and how they actually used a controversial program as a platform for their own views. So I realize it's a bit of a controversial point, and I'd be interested to learn more and see some of the other influences that came into view.
Any other questions? Thank you so much, Heather, for your presentation. You're the man, Kevin.